part way open, and the duty sergeant was sitting just inside the entrance, his rifle laid across his knees. He asked with his eyebrows whether the chaplain meant to step inside.
"They're all abed, I'm afraid," he said, his voice low.
"That's all right," said Devlin, also speaking quietly. "I'll only be a moment." The bullet had been removed from Stane's shoulder, and his wound had been stitched. His filthy clothes had been cut from his body, and the dirt washed from his face and hair. He had been dressed in moleskin trousers and a loose twill shirt, donated by Tigreen's Hardware, on promise of payment the following day. Throughout all these ministrations, the boy had drifted in and out of consciousness, mumbling Anna's name. When he became aware, however, that the physician meant to install him at the Criterion Hotel opposite the police camp, his eyes snapped open at once. He would not leave Anna. He would not go anywhere that Anna did not go. He put up such a fuss to this effect that at length the physician agreed to placate him. A bed was made up for him at the jailhouse next to where Anna lay, and it was decided that Staines would be manacled like the others in the interests of preventing disharmony. The boy consented to the manacle without protest, lay down, and reached out a hand to touch Anna's cheek. After a time his eyes closed, and he slept. Since then he had not woken. He and Anna lay facing each other, Staines lying on his left hip and Anna on her right, both of them with their knees drawn up to their chests. Staines with one hand tucked beneath his bandaged shoulder, Anna with one arm tucked beneath her cheek. She must have turned towards him some time in the night. Her left arm was flung outward, her fingers reaching, her palm turned down. Devlin came closer. He felt overcome, though by what kind of sentiment he did not exactly know. George Shepherd's whiskey had warmed his chest and stomach. There was a blurry tightness in his skull, a blurry heat behind his eyes. But the jailer's story had made him feel wretched, even chilled. Perhaps he was about to weep. It would feel good to weep. What a day it had been! His heart was heavy, his limbs exhausted. He looked down at Anna and Emery, their mirrored bodies facing in. They were breathing in tandem. "So they are lovers," he thought, looking down at them. "So they are lovers, after all." He knew it from the way that they were sleeping. Part 4. Paingafafa, the 27th of April, 1865, 45 degrees 52 minutes south, 170 degrees 30 minutes east, Dunedin. And the 27th of April, 1866, 42 degrees 43 minutes south, 170 degrees 58 minutes east, Hokitika. First point of Aries, in which a steamer arrives in Port Chalmers from Sydney, and two passengers are roused before the rest. Anna Wetherill's first glimpse of New Zealand was of the rocky heads of the Otago Peninsula, mottled cliffs that dropped sharply into the white foam of the water, and above them a rumpled cloak of grasses raked by the wind. It was just past dawn. A pale fog was rising from the ocean, obscuring the far end of the harbour, where the hills became blue and then purple as the inlet narrowed and closed to a point. The sun was still low in the east, throwing a slick of yellow light over the water and lending an orange tint to the rocks on the western shore. The city of Dunedin was not yet visible, tucked as it was behind the elbow of the harbour, and there were no dwellings or livestock on this stretch of coastline. Anna's first impression was of a lonely throat of water, a clear sky, and a rugged land untouched by human life or industry. The first sighting had occurred in the grey hours that preceded the dawn, and so Anna had not witnessed the smudge on the horizon growing and thickening to form the contour of the peninsula as the steamer came nearer and nearer to the coast. She had been woken some hours later by a strange cacophony of unfamiliar bird calls, from which she deduced rightly that they must be nearing land at last. She eased herself from her berth, taking care not to wake the other women, and fixed her hair and stockings in the dark, By the time she came up the iron ladder to the deck, wrapping her shawl about her shoulders, the fortunate wind was rounding the outer heads of the harbour, and the peninsula was all around her. The relief, sudden and impossible, after long weeks at sea. "Magnificent, aren't they?" Anna turned. A fair-haired boy in a felt cap was leaning against the portside rail. He gestured to the cliffs, and Anna saw the birds whose rancorous call had roused her from her slumber. They hung in a cloud about the cliff face, wheeling, turning, and catching the light. She came forward to the rail. They looked to her like very large gulls, their wings black on the tops and white beneath, their heads perfectly white, their beaks stout and pale. As she watched, one made a low pass in front of the boat, its wingtips skimming the surface of the water.
"Beautiful," she said. "Are they petrels, or gannets, maybe?"
"They're albatrosses."
The boy was beaming.
"They're real albatrosses. Just wait till this fellow comes back. He will in a moment. He's been circling the ship for some time. Good Lord, what a feeling that must be, to fly. Can you imagine it?"
Anna smiled. She watched as the albatross glided away from them, turned, and began climbing on the wind.
"They're terrifically good luck albatrosses," the boy was saying, "and they're the most incredible flyers. One hears stories of them following ships for months and months, and through all manner of weather, halfway around the world sometimes. Lord only knows where these ones have been, and what they've witnessed, for that matter."
When it turned on its side, it became almost invisible, a needle of white, pale against the sky.
"So few birds are truly mythical," the boy went on, still watching the albatross. "I mean, there are ravens, I suppose, and perhaps you might say that doves have a special meaning too, but no more than owls do, or eagles. An albatross is different. It has such a weight to it, such symbolism. It's angelic, almost. Even saying the name, one feels a kind of thrill. I'm so glad to have seen one. I feel almost touched. And how wonderful that they guard the mouth of the harbour like they do. How's that for an omen? For a gold town? I heard them calling. That was what roused me. And I came topside because I couldn't place the sound. I thought it was pigs at first."
Anna looked at him sidelong. Was the boy making an overture of friendship? He was speaking as if they were close familiars, though in fact they had not exchanged more than perfunctory greetings on the journey from Sydney, Anna having kept largely to the women's quarters and the boy to the men's.